Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1343.MT2514, certificate number 25007, Trucker Culture.
We've talked about this before, but you were born in 74. Do you remember the 1970s?
Hardly at all. I mean, I have plenty of memories from the 70s, but they're not 70s-y.
Right.
Unless I look back at my photos and I see that I'm wearing tough skins and garanimals.
And you've said, you've also expressed some concern that the Omnibus is maybe overloaded with cultural references from the 70s and 80s because those are our time.
If we just want to make a time capsule and put in like a 1975 JCPenney catalog... We could just do that. We don't have to go to all this trouble.
Well, I do feel like our impulse is often to do 18th and 19th century European entries, and we have to kind of fight that. And our default is then to go to some weird pop culture thing in the 80s.
Every time we mention the Kaiser, we also have to mention Kuschballs or something.
Right.
It's the Kaiser Kuschball rule.
Yeah, I feel like I could do entries every week on some Austro-Hungarian minor duke.
What if you just kept doing dukes and I would just be like, and then they had Wally Walkers. It looked like an octopus, but if you threw it at a window, it went down the window. Crazy.
But 70s culture, you know, I was born, I'm 6 years older than you are. So I was born during the waning days of the Johnson administration. Of the two of us, I'm the only one that was born before the moon landing. So that makes me... I think that should be a prerequisite for...
You've lived in a pre-moon era?
I have.
I think it's more to my credit that I refuse to live in a world where man had not walked on the moon. I have a higher standard than you, apparently.
The thing is, I was there. You know what I mean? Like, you can
on the moon?
You can only read about it. Well, like all citizens of the Earth in 1969, I was there on the moon with our intrepid moonwalkers.
Weren't you like 7 months old or something?
Yeah, but there with them, I'm sure I was in front of the TV as it all happened.
The problem is I remember almost no 70s culture. Like when I'm old enough to actually remember cultural import, it's all Reagan era. So the number of things that happened in the 70s that I remember, I can count on, like national events, I can count on one hand. I remember the Carter running for re-election, and I remember the Sonics winning the title in 79.
Right.
And I remember that big solar eclipse across the western U.S. that was in summer of 79, or I can't remember.
Yeah, right. I was in Alaska at that point, so I didn't see the eclipse, but I remember my mom and sister took pictures of it.
So except for that, you know, and the only TV I'm watching is The Muppet Show.
Right.
And maybe game shows. So I'm not super connected to America in the mohair 70s, wall-to-wall 70s.
Well, that six-year difference between the two of us is it doesn't really change our appreciation of late 90s, early 2000s indie rock because we were both there. I was maybe a little bit... I would have been aged out of it if I hadn't been an active participant in it.
You were making it.
Yeah,
so you got grandfathered in.
I was 30 years old. I should have already gotten a job at Amazon, but I was still playing my guitar. But it makes a huge difference in how we appreciated 70s culture because I turned 12 in 1980, so the 70s were really the foundational years.
That's what makes you. It really people is. People in the future are going to want to know what explains John Roderick. And I will say, look to the Ford administration.
That's right.
Youngsters.
Well, it really was true. And one of the songs that most influenced me, there were a few songs that stood out throughout my childhood. And this was an era where there were, where the way you received popular music was on the radio, often AM radio, and you would hear the song of the summer playing out of the cab of everybody's Chevy stepside pickup or recently purchased Camaro. And the music of Elton John is like so baked into my DNA that I can't, I mean, I can still listen to Philadelphia Freedom and just go immediately back to a little kid, like, dow-ow-ow. But there were a few songs that just came out of nowhere and walloped me. One of them was Devil Woman by Cliff Richard, a very late period hit for Cliff Richard. Same cat with them evil eyes, and I knew it was a spell she cast. She's just a devil woman with evil on her mind. Beware the devil woman, she's gonna get you. She's just a devil woman with evil on her mind.
I thought no American ever heard a Cliff Richard song. I thought British people just had to explain Cliff Richard to us.
Well, there was this crazy mid-70s hit where he did a very spooky tune called Devil Woman that just connected with me as a kid. But
and it was really maybe out of character for
she's
his
just
for
a
his
devil infant. Woman with
he must have
evil
actually,
on her mind.
He must have actually conjured some kind of a devil woman.
It was crazy. I think he met her at the crossroads. He went down to the crossroads to try to catch a ride.
Do you think Satan was controlling Cliff Richard in the 70s?
I'm not 100% sure Satan wasn't controlling Cliff Richard the entire time.
It's the long con.
I mean, if you think about the taboo rhythms in rock and roll, Satan's been controlling us all since he introduced the blues to Robert Johnson.
It's funny that he was just waiting so long. Satan just lets classical and opera develop.
Yeah, well,
he doesn't really care that much.
Gilbert and Sullivan, is there much Satan in Gilbert and Sullivan?
I would say there's almost no Satan.
No Satan.
In Gilbert and Sullivan.
I think you could put a little bit of Satan in Mozart, for sure. There's plenty of Satan in there. I mean, maybe it's not immediately apparent, but that's how Satan works.
The Magic Flute is full of, I think, Freemasonry. So that's how Satan works for sure.
Well, right. He's on that's, the...
at that time, he had not yet switched to the blues because he was able to control Western civilization through Freemasonry and the Illuminati.
Right. Through his one eye on the top of a pyramid.
He had a good thing going.
Well, yeah. He's, I mean, George Washington, right, is wearing his Masonic apron and changing the face of history.
Yeah. Satan's still on the dollar bill. So...
Well, I think in addition to the Satan conjured by Devil Woman, the number one song of my childhood and one that connected with me profoundly was a song called Convoy by C.W. McCall. It has a tremendous, it creates sonically, before the lyrics even start, it creates this environment in the room that is a little bit country, a little bit rock and roll. It's very American. It has a kind of like a high-pitched drone that comes in. And then
that strikes you as the American sound.
It's the sound of the American highway.
I've definitely been in restaurants overseas, and you can tell when a loud American comes in and orders. You can hear that high pitched drone all the way across the restaurant.
But
a literal high pitched drone, you know, bombing a wedding or something.
Right, sure.
That's the other. That's
a high
the other.
Altitude drone.
It starts high and starts to get low.
But the 70s were a kind of remarkable time. The 60s were over. One of the residues of the 60s was the kind of back to the landism. The 60s
sure,
had also...
We talked about that kind of denim American revival before.
But it was also a period simultaneous to the psychedelic rock of the of San Francisco was a real... like explosive country western culture that
that was semi-mainstreamed. You
it
know?
Was very mainstream.
You, if you were not a country fan, you would still just love Kenny Rogers and
Barbara Mandrell.
Sure, you'd watch the Mandrell sisters every night on their variety show. You knew Dolly Parton's every song. That was not kind of a walled off part of American culture, and it certainly was not regional.
No, it was popular music, and it was like rock and roll. It evolved from the same font, the same combination of the blues and hillbilly music, but it took it in a different direction, a more, it was the music of rural America rather than urban America. And in fact, we've talked about it, I think, before, but the charts, right, the top 40 were largely self-reporting. There, we didn't have a way to actually monitor the sales of records. It was the RIAA.
I would have had way more number one hits if I'd been a singer in the self-reported era.
The self-reported era.
Yeah, I just got to say, my song is, it's really huge.
Oh, it wasn't like going to school in an alternative high school where you just
what's your
name
grade?
Your own grade. But it was.
Ken, how many records do you think you sold? Oh, 10 million.
A++. No, the reporting was done by record stores, and every week the record stores would report, and the radio stations would report the most popular music. Mm-hmm. Well, record stores and radio stations tended to be owned and operated by rock and roll people, and so they would over-report the significance of Elton John or Queen or Led Zeppelin, and really under-report the sales of country, western music, and soul music. So it wasn't until that became a standardized reporting system. It happened in the 90s where record stores and radio stations started reporting actual sales.
And then you could suddenly see like not a single rock record.
Right.
And that was off the charts again.
The explosive realization that rap music and country music were the two biggest genres of music in the country, and rock music immediately lost a lot of its cachet as a business within the record industry.
But what about all those people I knew in high school that said they liked everything except rap and country?
They like everything except rap and country, right? Well, what they were talking about was
bizarro world versions of theirs that liked nothing except rap and country.
And it's crazy to think that throughout the 80s, the big records in the 80s were Peter Gabriel records or whatever, Def Leppard records. But in fact, that whole time, country records and rap records were...
Phil Collins was sitting on a throne of lies. It's funny that, rap and country were the most popular strains of music, and we needed a Kid Rock to come to us and unite those two traditions.
I believe that futurelings will agree with me that we did not need Kid Rock, and we do not need him now. But when I first heard Convoy, so that song arrived in...
What year is that?
1976, I think. 1975 or 6. So I was 8 years old, and the song tells a story. And it tells a story of truckers communicating to one another via CB radio. And it's clear from the lyrics that they are sort of forming a convoy. It's this nascent convoy.
Well, it's clear from the title that they're forming a convoy.
Well, not necessarily. It could be a convoy that was already formed.
Or a convoy in their hearts.
But the lyrics begin, and I've had these lyrics memorized since I was 8 years old. But
this is the way I know that 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, every verse of Convoy.
So it was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth hauling logs. So we know right away that we're in a Kenworth. He's hauling logs.
I've got a perfect mental picture. It's like I'm there in the cab.
It's a cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs.
I don't know what cab over Pete or a reefer is. I assume a Jimmy hauling hogs is a truck full of pigs.
That's right. So a Jimmy would be a GMC big rig, not a GMC little truck.
Right.
But they also made semi trucks.
And a Peterbilt.
A cab over Pete is a Peterbilt, but it's one of those trucks that looks like a square block. It doesn't have a nose, right?
Yes.
It's called a cab over. The cab is directly over the motor.
Okay. And a reefer on means he's smoking a joint.
No, a reefer is a trailer that is refrigerated.
A refrigeration.
So it's a refrigerated truck.
This is a whole little secret language you have to speak just to understand the first sentence of this song.
It is. And there are three, so we're talking about three trucks, right? You've got the cab over Pete. You've got the Jimmy hauling hogs.
And the log truck.
Right. And a Kenworth driving logs there, right? They were headed for Bear on I-10, just a mile out of Shaky Town.
Okay. I-10 is I-10.
That's right. And Shaky Town is Los Angeles because because
you can go to Shaky's Pizza there?
No, because of earthquakes.
Oh, that makes sense. It feels like a lot of their slang is unnecessary. like when a waitress is like, Adam and Eve on a raft or whatever. Like, isn't that more syllables than poached eggs or whatever it means?
I'll explain in a minute. But then the end of the first verse is...
And heading for bear means they're going fast.
Yeah, that's right. Because the bear is Smokey Bear, which is the cops. And they're called Smokey Bear because they wear Smokey Bear hats.
Oh, I thought this was like they're loaded for bear or whatever. You think bear actually refers to police?
Bear is police.
So they're heading towards police.
Well, yeah, there are cops up ahead. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Mile Out of Shaky Town. I said Pigpen, who we can assume is the Jimmy Holland Hogs.
I thought it was the Peanuts character, Pigpen.
No, it's Pigpen is driving the hog truck. Pigpen, this here's the rubber duck. I'm about to put the hammer down. So we learn that the narrator of this song is Rubber Duck. That's his handle, his nom de plume, nom de truck.
Nom de CB.
Right. And he's about to put the hammer down, which is to say that he's about to accelerate his truck on I-10 out of Shaky Town.
It's not clear that it's a first-person song until right then when Rubber Duck begins to speak.
Right. Because it was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June. That sounds like it was a dark and stormy night.
We seem to be seeing three trucks from omniscient point of view, but we now know that we are Rubber Duck.
Right.
Presumably in the Kenworth, I guess.
Rubber Duck is telling us this story.
Yeah.
So as a child, boy, I was captivated certainly by all of the what seemed to be crazy words that were all thrown together very confidently by this narrator. He wasn't just speaking gibberish, and this wasn't for kids. This was a secret language in a secret world.
You're just thrown into another world.
Right. And the song jams. You know, it's got a kind of Nashville or Bakersfield trucking along sort of Telecaster sound.
Convoy slaps? Is that your judgment?
Slaps? Is this a term of art that you and your...
That's what the kids are saying.
Your young people... Slaps.
The young people today.
The tune slaps.
Do you think it's a bop?
Do you think it's
a jam?
I don't think it slaps. It's definitely a jam, but slaps must be referring to some kind of contemporary music that...
Only music made after 2015 can slap?
Yeah, it makes a sound that... I mean, no music before that would slap be a compliment.
What if a young person today listens to Convoy and says that this song slaps? Wouldn't you be flattered?
No, that young person doesn't know what they're talking about. And the thing is, futurelings are going to say something completely else, like... Oh, this is a
splunk.
Yeah, this ectoplasms. But we were primed to hear that song and respond to it, in part because the early 70s were a time when interstate trucking had become...
Inexplicably.
Inexplicably had become a kind of national phenomenon, and there are a couple of reasons for this.
So, and let me understand this. Convoy follows the fact that there's already a bit of a craze around CB and truckers in general?
So what happened, there were a few moments. After World War II, you had a confluence of factors. One of them was we started work on the interstate highway system. Another was that trucking became an even more important way of goods and services moving around the country.
Yeah, I assume the railroad was prevalent up until the mid-20th century.
But right? The railroad can only reach where the railroad goes.
Exactly.
But it was the dawn of consumerism in large part, right? Goods were moving around the country. There were newfangled toasters and ovens and vacuum cleaners that were driving the economy. Everybody was moving to the suburbs and needed to outfit their new mid-century homes with all the
latest
mod-cons.
Dishwasher.
And also fresh fruit and vegetables, foodstuffs.
Logs, hogs.
They were all moving by truck. And it was the era where the Teamsters Union was its most powerful. It was the largest union in the country. And this was the era.
You think it's some kind of mob conspiracy to make trucking look cool?
No, it was, I think, a factor of this also being the era where the corporate man came into existence, the man in the gray flannel suit. And we were seeing an era of kind of social hegemony. It was a conformist time.
So we envy the free man.
The trucker started to assume some of the mantle of the cowboy. It was the last, they were the last independent people out on the road.
That's sad to me.
Well,
because there actually is adventure and drama in the life of a cowboy, I would assume.
And
Trucker's just a guy peeing in a bottle.
Well, at the time, there was a lot of adventure in the life of a trucker. They were, again, the interstate highways were just coming into being, and there were still very regional aspects to America. If you were in Oklahoma, it was very, very different from being in Oregon. The restaurants, the culture, and this homogenization hadn't happened in American culture. So it's
glamorous that these guys can travel all the highways and byways of this great land. They're the only ones who see it all.
That's right. They've seen it all, and they are also out there, you know, meeting with each other in the rough and tumble world, and they, you know, they have a girl in every town, and this is before containerized shipping. So there's quite a bit of access to, there's a lot of graft. There's, you know, if you have a truck full of blenders and a couple go missing, no one notices. It was also an era where gasoline was cheap. And so the romance of the road, the trucker became maybe one of the last seafaring men.
Do you know what I thought was romantic about truckers when I was a kid? Not that any truckers had romantic interest in me when I was a kid.
Right. No, you were in Korea.
It was the other way around. But that they drove at night.
Right.
Right? They have all their adventures by the dark of the moon on the 6th of June. That's, you know, right. They don't work a 9-to-5 like us. They're the only ones out there while the rest of us sleep having all these adventures. And today I know it's actually not all that adventurous. They're just trying to get to Tulsa on time.
But. Well, trucking has changed, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, the first trucker movie is actually called They Drive by Night. It was from 1940. It was a Humphrey Bogart movie.
I've seen They Drive by Night.
And it, you know, it paints a pretty glamorous picture.
I guess it didn't occur dramatic. To me that that's so much of the audience grabber. You put it in the title.
Yeah.
Now check it out. You've seen people that drive, right? Well, these guys, they drive by night, if you can believe it.
Boom.
Exciting.
It's been suggested that trucking is the topic of more country and Western songs than any other working class occupation. So all the country songs about being a working man, a dam builder, and a steel driving man, and all these things.
I love country songs about dam builders.
That's
my favorite.
That was the Highwayman song, right? I'm a dam builder.
Okay. I was a dam builder across
on a river deep and wide. Oh, boy. I should cover that song. Where steel and water did collide. But trucking, there are more trucking songs than all of the rest combined. So trucking became inextricably connected to that, the same world that country music appeals to, which is a kind of the rural America.
Middle American working men and women.
That's right.
Can I tell you, by the way, the first time I heard Convoy?
Yeah.
This is going to blow your mind.
It was 2015.
That is very clear. Yeah, it was this morning when you told me you wanted to do this show. No, in the 90s, I was at college and my roommate and I were driving home from something, but we both had our cars. And he just said, oh, I'll follow you. And he started to sing. We were going to somebody else's house. I'll follow you. And he started to sing. We got a little convoy rocking through the chorus.
We got a little convoy.
And I was like, okay, great. You made a little theme song for our drive to the party. And he said, no, that's Convoy. And I said, I don't know what that is. You've never heard Convoy? He was appalled that I had never heard this mid-70s country song, but I had somehow gone the first 25 years of my life.
Well, you continue to appall because earlier today you said, oh, apparently there's a movie called Convoy. And I said, are you kidding me? And you were like, no, seriously, there is. And I was like, no. I said, are you kidding me? Like, you've never heard of Convoy?
How many times have you seen the movie Convoy?
Well, the problem with the movie Convoy is it's a movie based on a song.
But Convoy does have a lot of plot.
It does. It's not the best movie. But the plot of Convoy hinges on another sort of foundational moment in trucker culture. Now, to go back a little bit, during this same rise of the interstate highway and the romance of the trucker, there was happening simultaneously and in an unconnected way, the rise of citizens band radio. And we've talked about that on Omnibus before.
When we were talking about ham call signs. Right?
Ham call signs, right. But this was an era where what had formerly been the airwaves were restricted to broadcasters, there were now some airwaves, some bands were now reserved for public use. So you could have your own little ham radio. You could use some of these bandwidths to for people to communicate with one.
And this was like a legislative change that happened in the 70s or something?
Yeah, well, not in the 70s, but gradually throughout the 50s and 60s, the restrictions on being able to broadcast, some bands were reserved for public use. And they were actually bands that had formerly been assigned to some authority, and they were taken away and they were allocated to the population at large. There were
whatever hobbyists or professionals thought they needed their own radio.
Right. If you were a radio dispatched cab, or if you were somebody that was working for an auto parts store and you needed to keep in touch with the, you know, it was still for commercial use and you had to have a license in order to be a broadcaster, like a ham radio license.
And radios were getting cheaper and smaller too, right, which I'm sure helped.
So these radios and the ability to have a radio in your truck, that happened sort of gradually and unconnected to the rise of trucker culture. Mm-hmm. But in the early 1970s, we experienced an energy crisis. The price of gasoline went through the roof, and it really affected long-distance truckers who, you know, gas prices were absorbed, you know, that was the cost of doing business. And when gas had been cheap, truckers were driving the country, you know, making a comfortable middle-class living. But this energy crisis hit trucking really hard. And an interesting factor in truck driving was, although the majority, 70% of truckers were Teamsters, and so were unionized and mm-hmm. had, and the union was able to establish standard rates for things, and the union was able to pay benefits to truck drivers, 30% of the truckers were independent. And it was because of a loophole in the Interstate Commerce Act that exempted truck drivers that were delivering foodstuffs.
In your reefer?
That's right. Food truck drivers didn't have to, they were unregulated. And so food producers could contract with owner-operators to move their produce around.
And they weren't worried about the Teamsters putting them in concrete somewhere?
Well, the Teamsters had a really difficult time unionizing food trucks because it had become a local economy. And if you were living in the strawberry fields and you had your own truck or two trucks, you and your son had trucks, it was tough for the Teamsters to get in there and unionize each one of these little
family businesses. Yeah.
And the effect of this non-unionized food trucking industry was one of the elements that brought the price of food down in the United States. So food, which had formerly been, and fresh food, which had formerly been, you know, a major expense, became cheaper and cheaper. And then food was disseminated more widely. And low food costs were a component of the boom times in the United States, just like low gas costs.
Sure. Previous to this, you would probably just buy the two or three kinds of fruit that were in season.
Right.
You would not, it's not like going to the store today where you can, suddenly you have blueberries from wherever.
And, sure, strawberries in the middle of the winter and whatnot.
Coming from Chile.
But those drivers were even more adversely affected by the gas crisis because, you know, they weren't receiving standard rates. They were in a market economy and they absorbed the gas prices. But even worse, as the energy crisis deepened, gas just wasn't available. That was the time of long, long gas lines. This was before you were born, but I remember waiting in line at a gas station for a long time.
I think you shouldn't have been driving, in my opinion. In Alaska, you're a 3 or 4 year old should not be driving.
I was sitting in the back seat playing with one of the dolls made out of straw that they used to give us as children, like a little tank.
You were playing with one of those little tanks of water where you press the button and the hoop jumps around.
The hoop squirts around.
Yeah.
Actually, when you were a kid back then, they just gave you a guitar and they said, "You feeling sad? Play the blues."
Was it Satan? Did Satan come to you and give you a guitar?
I wondered who gave me that guitar. It was Satan.
This slaps.
Well, so here we are in 19, and this first energy crisis happened in 1973. Trucking was a major industry in the United States. There was a component of trucking that were owner operators, and CB radios had propagated throughout the trucking industry, and during this period, CBs started to be used a lot as a way for truckers to say to one another, like, hey, there's gasoline available over here. Hey, there's, you know, you need to watch out for this road closure and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It became not just a way for truckers to stay in touch with home base, but for them to communicate with one another. And Channel 9 was always reserved for emergency services, but there were a couple of different channels. There was one channel that was sort of open communication for trucks east of the Mississippi, and then west of the Mississippi, it was Channel 19. And gradually, Channel 19 became the trucker channel nationwide. If you were out on the road, you put yourself on Channel 19.
What was the range, though? I mean...
Well, so there were limitations on how big of a broadcaster you could have. Initially, it was 5 watts.
Which is going to be very local.
It's very local, and there were limitations on how big your antenna could be, but this was very difficult to regulate. And as trucking expanded and more people got into it, they would, on the sly, or, you know, pirate radio style, they would increase their amplification and increase the size of their antenna, and gradually trucks were able to communicate over pretty long distances.
It must be a lonely life too. It must have been nice to just be able to chat in your cab and not just have to wait till the truck stop.
Yeah, it was a very, very early form of social networking within a group of like-minded individuals. But another thing happened right after the energy crisis of 73, which was that the federal government imposed a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit.
Oh, man. Pissing off Sammy Hagar.
Pissing off Sammy Hagar and everybody else. And what this did was put a further imposition on truckers, because they are not paid for the time they spend on the road. You know, sure. They're paid by delivery.
They want to get there as fast as possible.
And paid by distance. So if you're driving 2,500 miles and you can do it in the space of 16 hours, you are a lot better off than if it takes you 30 hours because of restrictions, because you're waiting in line for gas and then you can only go 55.
I mean, so, it's the reason they drive all night, right? It's right. Whether it's safe or good for them or not.
And, you know, yeah, you have the open road. You can go as fast as you want. So mm-hmm. Then there also developed an antagonistic relationship between cops and truckers, because truckers, there was a real incentive for them to speed. And there was a real incentive for them to use their CB radios to alert one another to the presence of troopers or county cops or county mounties, as they're called.
The drop to 55 must have been crazy in the West, because I think a lot of states, you could just drive, what, 70 or 75 or more?
Montana
had no speed limits. So you're effectively dropping truck speed limits 20 or 30 miles per hour in some places.
Well, and if you're in one of those big rigs, you can go 80 miles an hour and your truck feels pretty steady. It's a real skateboard. And at 55 miles an hour, you're not even out of third gear. So all of a sudden there was... A trucker culture became, and it already had a cowboy Wild West association, but now they were outlaws.
Yeah.
And America loves an outlaw.
I like how their crime is speeding on the interstate.
Speeding on the interstate.
our new outlaws of the 70s.
And also, you know, not just speeding, but conspiring with one another to thwart the law.
Using disrespectful nicknames for law enforcement.
And this was how a lot of this sort of secret language of CB trucker culture came about, because initially they could talk that way on the radio and cops listening in wouldn't be able to decipher
their
code.
It's like a criminal argot. It's the same way, you know, Parisian pickpockets in the 19th century were speaking some weird language.
And I think probably why diner waitresses also throw that stuff around. Really? If you're not sure what shit on a shingle is, I guess everybody knew what that was. But if you don't know what two chickens on a hot tin roof with a blueberry milkshake is, if you hadn't ordered a blueberry milkshake.
The stakes seem much lower there.
Yeah, perhaps.
That might just be trying to entertain yourself at a very boring job.
Perhaps, who knows? So the early mid-70s, combined with this denimification of youth culture, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was a huge film. There was a resurgence in the idea of cowboys and outlaws as American archetypes. And here we had interstate truckers, and the interstates had only been that system was still under construction, the interstate highway system.
That's literally a new frontier. Yeah.
A new frontier.
Or sorry, frontier. People get mad when I say frontier, the Shatner way.
Did you say frontier? I didn't quite hear it.
I say because Shatner always says space, the final frontier.
Frontier.
It must be his weird Montreal accent.
I get upset with that now. Now, I didn't even notice it before.
Frontier's not incorrect. I think if you look in the dictionary, frontier might be ahead of frontier.
Yeah, frontier sounds like somebody
would. It's in the front. They put it in the front.
It would be something that someone in Dodge City said, and we don't talk like that anymore. But now there was, and also outlaw country music was ascendant. So it all combined.
You already mentioned the Highwaymen. That's a country supergroup literally named after outlaws. Like, we're supposed to believe that Kris Kristofferson and Johnny Cash are holding up trains.
Well, and all those guys, right? Waylon Jennings. I mean, they were the progenitors of outlaw country, even in the 60s and early 70s. Mm-hmm. So then the song Convoy arrives, which was written in this argot by a songwriter ostensibly called C.W. McCall. And he appears on the cover of his record, and he looks like a real truck-driving man. He's got a cowboy hat on. He's got a denim shirt on. He seems like a true American truck-driving cowboy.
But he's very much of the era, too. Like, he looks kind of like John Denver.
He looks like John Denver.
It's like Cousin Oliver finally got his truck.
But what it turned out was that there was no C.W. McCall. In fact, C.W. McCall was a fiction.
It was a hologram.
He was a fiction, a gnome de country, a gnome de country music of a man named William Dale Fries, who was an advertising executive.
So it's minstrelsy. He's pretending to be one of these Western outlaw types.
Right. And he later went on to be one of the founders of Mannheim Steamroller, who made my family's favorite Christmas album. Yep, that's Mannheim Steamroller.
It's like eight Casios finally found religion and became self-aware.
Some of that record, if you get past the early synth stuff on it, some of those Christmas carols are maybe the best renditions of them. So their version, it's kind of a choral silent night. There's beautiful music on that album.
Don't Mannheim splain to me. I don't care about their Christmas album.
No, listen to it all the way through. Put it on. Call on Spotify. I'm going to say this to all the people listening to Omnibus in the future. I'm going to say this right out. Hey, Siri. Play Mannheim Steamroller Christmas album.
Mannheim Steamroller slaps. I'm a Trans-Siberian orchestra guy. You can't convert me.
Alexa, play Mannheim Steamroller Christmas album.
You have to predict all the names of digital assistants in the future. Splingdorf.
Corinthiana, play Mannheim Steamroller Christmas album. But C.W. McCall became a big, big star. Convoy was... went to number one on both the pop charts and the country charts.
I see his Wikipedia entry goes to great lengths to tell me he is not a one-hit wonder, which you really only see on one-hit wonders.
He had a second single.
Did you know he had a pirate-themed nautical follow-up called Round the World with the Rubber Duck?
No.
I guess he one-upped his trucking single to have a maritime theme.
Did he Optimus Prime his truck and then turn it into a boat?
Yeah, how's he getting across the ocean? But apparently Rubber Duck winds up in England, Germany, Russia, and Japan, so.
Well, so Convoy did inspire the movie Convoy, starring Kris Kristofferson, but that was not
What's your favorite movie inspired by a song? I like the Sandra Bullock Love Potion number 9.
There's something about, what was the one that was, they couldn't use Mary. There's something about Gary. What was that movie in the 90s? No, not something about Mary. It was, Along Comes Polly.
Because the association wouldn't let them use Along Comes Mary.
Yeah, they couldn't use Along Comes Mary. I don't know why. But I hated that title. I never saw the movie. Along Comes Polly. What a dumb thing.
Like, we're in an age now where there's, you know, they're optioning Battleship and... they're optioning board games like Battleship.
You sank my Battleship, but don't.
No, but they're ringing them into massive movies. But we don't have a lot of song-inspired movies anymore. Well, Harper Valley PTA and Yellow Submarine, and that was about it, I guess.
Right, Harper Valley PTA came out of that song, right? Not the other way around.
It's always songs that are stories. You know?
Narrative, right?
Like Alice's Restaurant, and yeah, Love Potion Number 9 is about a guy who goes down to Madame Rue. Hey, this writes itself. Who can we get to be the gypsy? Maybe Lainey Kazan.
It made sense to have Kris Kristofferson be the trucker. He's born to play that role.
He's perfect.
But although there had been some trucker movies or truck movies before Convoy, Like, for instance, Steven Spielberg's first movie, Duel, where the truck is driven
by... that's an anti-trucking movie. Yeah. We're supposed to be cheering for Dennis Weaver, the car driver.
Well, it's an anonymous, like, bad truck driver.
But it's almost like he's not even a trucker. Like, you're scared of the truck, you know? Like, the trucker and truck are just one organism.
Right.
You can't separate them.
But it is, you know, it is... the truck is an outlaw in that situation.
It's true. It doesn't care about your rules.
The trucker... Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't even explain that in 1973, as a result of this energy crisis and these restrictions, truckers went on strike, and there was a nationwide strike of truckers refusing to deliver their goods and services that basically paralyzed whole sections of the American industry.
I'm going to say mostly goods.
Well, no.
Services from truckers are mostly limited to what they do
in
truck stop restrooms, and we'll be okay without that.
I suppose you're right. Although, a lot of people in service industries that relied on goods and services, were now no longer able to provide their services.
It's a slippery slope. You start to mess up the goods, and pretty soon, services go too.
So, for instance, the whole, like, slaughterhouse industry came to a standstill because nobody was moving trucks or cows and pigs.
It's the day no pigs could die.
The auto industry, like, temporarily laid off thousands of people because parts couldn't be transported to make new cars.
I love the idea of truckers flexing their power.
And no food moved around the country. So suddenly grocery stores were similarly restricted. And what truckers wanted was...
to bring the country to its knees.
Well, and to bring the price of gas down. They wanted an artificial reduction in... they didn't want gas to be a commodity on the open market. They wanted to restrict its price. And what the Teamsters were able to do was add a 6% gas surcharge to the price of delivery. Independent truckers weren't quite able to do that.
Well, that's how it should have worked, right? The truckers shouldn't have been eating that.
Right, and... that crisis was resolved for the most part, but there were a lot of independent truckers and a lot of truckers in trucker culture from that point forward became rebellious because they understood that they were no longer just romantic. They now needed to fight for themselves. There was a television show during this period immediately after that trucker strike called Movin' On, which was about some truck drivers.
Claude Akins.
Living their lives. And then in 1975, a movie called White Line Fever, which was a great connection between a Vietnam vet coming back, taking over his father's trucking company, and then he discovers that bad men have infiltrated the trucking industry and are extorting truck drivers to carry contraband. And he's a one-man Vietnam vet who stands up to these bad guys and with his, you know, trucker...
He's not in a convoy. He's against the convoy.
He's against them all. But then Convoy comes out, and it, along with the song Convoy, the idea of the trucker explodes nationwide. And we see in the next 5 years so many trucker movies that it's very hard to see anything comparable really before or since, where an idea like this takes over American popular culture.
It does show people just chasing profit, you know? Like, if Smokey and the Bandit was a hit, let's make 10 more Smokey and the Bandits.
That's right.
Let's have, I remember when I was a kid in the early 80s, Tyco was still making these little slot trucks, like HO scale, like instead of rail model trains, people were playing with little model trucks.
Yeah, driving your truck around and speeding.
What could be more fun than that?
Eliminating Smokey. But so here's a short list of some of the trucker movies. You talked about Smokey and the Bandit, which was...
only because that's the only one I know.
But Smokey and the Bandit made trucking even more glamorous, and they were running contraband in that movie. And Jerry Reed...
what's the gimmick? They're trying to run Coors, or...?
Yeah, so Coors beer was, I think... in the Rocky Mountain states, Coors was a very, very popular, fashionable, like, cool new beer.
But you couldn't get it.
But you couldn't get it across the Mississippi because of restrictions.
Big
on
beer.
Well, and yeah, and you needed that the beer was taxed in some way, and so Big Enos and Little Enos wanted Coors at their party in Atlanta, and they sent the Bandit in his Firebird Trans Am. And Jerry Reed, who was called, Little Man. No, something. What was he? He was
Little
called?
Man Tate.
Chicken Man. No, come on. Snowman. There it is.
Correct.
The Bandit and Cletus Snowman.
We have a big chance to make a run for some big bucks. 80,000 of them.
What are we going to do? Kidnap the Pope or something?
How'd you guess? No. We're just going to run over to Texarkana and pick up 400 cases of Coors. And bring it back in 28 hours.
Whoa.
That's called bootlegging, and that's against the law. Well, who gives a turkey when the Snowman and the Bandit are running the booze? No one can stop it.
Hold it.
They're charged with this task. Go get a truckload of Coors and bring it back to the party. And if you can do it, then Little Enos is going to pay you.
The most, it's the most precious currency. It's like, what if instead of Bitcoin, Coors?
And that was not only a trucker movie, but a real CB movie. A lot of the dialogue in the film happens over CB radio.
Breaker, breaker.
That's right.
What's your 20?
And they use the CB to great effect. And the, you know, in fact, really, I'd say 90% of the spoken words go through a CB.
Well, civilians started buying CB radios, right? I don't want to take a detour from your movie list, but when I was a kid, my grandpa had a CB radio in the front of whatever Ford wagon he drove.
CBs went crazy.
And he loved having this.
So people just flouted the law. You still were required to have a license. It didn't cost very much money, but people just ignored it. You could buy CBs anywhere.
Was Radio Shack like a massive criminal empire?
Radio Shack bloomed. I have a truck parked out front. My 79 Suburban has a CB in it.
Oh, is it built into the dash?
No, but I think customized the day it came from the factory floor. My dad had a 74 Chrysler Imperial that had a CB in it for some reason, and we would talk to truckers. That actually later on contributed to the demise of CB radio because there were so many people on.
The truckers just didn't want to use it.
Yeah, just jibber jabber that truck drivers switched over to, you know, to a different system, or they changed channels. They tried to get away from all the.
We see that happen in social media today.
That's right.
Once all the old people are on Facebook,
where do you go?
All the cool young people are like, yeah, we're out of here.
You go to Grindr.
That's exactly right.
But Jerry Reed had a radio hit with Eastbound and Down, which was his sort of trucker tune.
Yeah.
Another sort of fun, lighthearted trucker movie. But there were two types of trucker movies. And one of the reasons that Convoy the movie was a difficult watch for me is that Convoy the song is fun. Convoy the movie is much more about trucker strikes and confrontation with the cops.
It's a Sam Peckinpah movie.
Yeah, people die.
I assume it's a bloody, violent massacre.
People die and it isn't fun. Smokey and the Bandit brought the fun back to trucking, and that Smokey and the Bandit was what gave us Dukes of Hazzard. That idea that, and Dukes of Hazzard was basically a CB television show. They were constantly on the CBs there.
But then law enforcement was able to get chips on the air to remind us that some law enforcement were solid, multiracial buddies.
Well,
and you shouldn't be against Boss Hogg.
You had Starsky and Hutch during this time too. I mean, but here are some movies. High Ballin', which also starred Jerry Reed and Peter Fonda. You had Breaker Breaker, which starred Chuck Norris. All the action heroes had to get in. White Line Fever, I think, was Jan Michael Vincent.
Oh, wow.
You had Every Which Way But Loose, which was Clint Eastwood.
And a monkey.
And an ape. And that spawned BJ and the Bear, which was a television show, basically where a trucker had an ape friend.
Bear.
That's right.
What happened to, you know the fad is going away when they start to have chimp sidekicks, right?
Right.
That's a bad sign.
There was a movie called The Great Smoky Roadblock, which starred Henry Fonda. not satisfied with his son having the only trucker movie in the family.
I like how Henry Fonda's not working much anymore, but he's like, well, mama, I always wanted to make a movie about truckers.
But the CB culture like went crazy in the country. We were talking earlier about the president's wife, Betty Ford. Was on Citizens Band Radio. She had her handle was First Mama.
I was looking this up because I had this very vague memory of Betty Ford being on CB radio. And it turned out because it was when Ford was running for re-election against Carter in 76, she had arthritis and couldn't campaign with him much. So she wanted it was a disability measure. She wanted a way that she could campaign for her husband without leaving the White House. So she got a CB handle and started, what's the verb for
Broadcasting? CBing?
There must be, there's not a cool
I think
squawk boxing or whatever.
I think it is CBing because I have a mug that I got in 76. It was given to me as a Christmas present or something. The mug is called the CBer, and it has all the little, like, put the hammer down and keep the bugs off your bumper and whatnot, all these little sayings on it. And it's called the CBer, so I have to assume that they were CBing.
CBN. So the president's wife is CBN with Rubber Duck and Company.
Well, I think probably another factor in Betty Ford using CB radios was that Jimmy Carter was from Atlanta, or from Georgia, from Plains, Georgia. And so he had a connection to rural American country Western culture. And the Fords probably seemed pretty stuffy.
From Michigan. They needed to appropriate Southern outlaw culture. And that's why she appeared on The Dukes of Hazzard 8 times. No, she did not appear on The Dukes of Hazzard.
Well, that's when Gerald Ford started playing the banjo on the campaign trail.
We all remember that time. No, wait, that was Kermit the Frog.
Well, and
I always get them confused.
You wonder, how much Jimmy Carter's viability as a presidential candidate was perhaps like subtly influenced by the popularity of this culture nationwide. I mean, you can't really think of a U.S. president in the 20th century before Carter that was so rooted in the South.
Yeah, not a lot of times when the South has been super cool.
No, I mean, Woodrow Wilson certainly wasn't from the South. So Carter, it was the South Will Rise Again era. We also had Lynyrd Skynyrd and all that Southern rock happening at the same time.
So you're saying the 55-mile speed limit elected Jimmy Carter?
I mean, I think the ascendancy of the South in the late 70s and early 80s was all tied up in this.
The funny thing is, it's all Burt Reynolds' fault after he gave us the great movie about how you should never go to the South, Deliverance.
That's right. He brought it back around.
Speaking of banjo players, he must have felt very bad. A lot of Southerners were like, Bert, that doesn't reflect our values, Bert.
Come on, Bert. Get it back on the right track.
We wouldn't do that to Ned Beatty. He's a right nice feller.
Even Mel Blanc was a very active CB user. Can you imagine driving a truck in California?
Like the Bugs Bunny guy?
And he would show up doing Porky Pig or Bugs Bunny, like in character. Biddy, biddy, biddy.
He's riding with hogs. Yeah. He's riding with a stuttering hog.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny how they all have kind of childlike names. They're all like Rubber Duck and Snowman. It all seems very cute. They're all named after Rainbow Brights or something.
Well, it was a funner time. But there was another energy crisis in 1979 and another trucker strike.
Is it because they lowered the speed limit to like 35?
No, it was still 55, but the energy crisis continued. And then this was an era of tremendous inflation. So up until this point, the Teamsters Union was the biggest in the country, and a truck driver could make a very comfortable living. An average truck driver in 1980 was making what would, adjusted for inflation, be about $110,000 a year. But in 1979, a tragedy befell the trucking industry, which is the deregulation of the trucking industry. This was an era in American politics where...
This is Reagan era yet or not?
Not quite, but Congress was trending that way. The idea being post-Nixon that regulation was strangling the American economy.
Soul.
And we needed to deregulate all of the industries that we'd formerly had all these oppressive controls over, and trucking was a big one. And in the aftermath of deregulation, there were a lot more owner-operators. It became a thing where union membership wasn't necessary to be a viable trucker. And initially that seemed like it was just right in keeping with trucker culture. Now an owner-operator could be his own man, his own Wild West character. But very quickly it was your typical deregulation race to the bottom. Mm-hmm. Truckers were in a price war with one another. It became simply a matter of how little you could charge rather than...
And is that true to this day? Is trucking mostly still deregulated and deunionized?
Trucking is deregulated and deunionized. There was a precipitous drop in Teamster membership. A lot of trucking companies started to contract with truckers so that they didn't have to pay benefits. Yeah. They didn't have to pay standardized rates, which means that every time the price of gas goes up, Those increased expenses are borne entirely by truckers. There's still regulation on truck drivers. In fact, not very long ago, there were restrictions put on how long a driver could drive in any 24-hour period, kind of like airline pilots. So now you have to keep a record of how long you drove and how long you slept, how long you took off. So truckers can't load up on speed and drive 18 hours anymore. So over the course of the subsequent years, truck driving has become an occupation where truckers struggle to make a living. Your average truck driver now makes $40,000 a year.
And probably works very long.
Works a lot harder and has to really scramble in order to put together a living. And during the 80s, after the deregulation happened, truckers lost a lot of their romantic appeal and started to be portrayed in the culture as serial killers and creeps. It no longer felt like they were the heroes of the Great American Highway.
Kings of the road?
No.
I have to say my one experience in a truck cab really made them seem like nobility to me. I was with some friends and we ran out of gas outside Battle Mountain, Nevada. It's middle of nowhere, like almost 30 miles from anywhere.
Right.
Nearest service station. And it was the middle of the night and we had no idea how we were going to hitchhike back. And almost immediately, a truck pulled over and said, "You boys okay? What happened?" You know, and this guy named Fuzzy, Fuzzy welcomed us into his cab.
But he wasn't a bear.
He was not a bear. He hated the bears.
Yeah.
He turned up the Merle Haggard or whatever, you know, right down the plate thing he was listening to, and took us all the way back to town and regaled us with the stories about driving the West. And it was great. It was like a time machine. And I was like, wow. Every time I feel bad about every time I've been annoyed by a big rig truck slowly passing another one on a Western interstate highway, because these guys are great.
Don't feel bad about that. A lot of trucks have speed governors on them. And so a lot of times when you're out on the highway and you see a truck in the fast lane inching past another truck.
Yeah. I think it's the state flag of Idaho.
It's because both trucks have speed governors. So they're both just going as fast as they can. And one of them is going a fraction of a mile an hour over the other one, but he wants to get by.
I think that's when you just have to suck it up. You know, like you need to go 58.5 miles an hour. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I hitchhiked a lot in the 1980s, and truckers typically did not stop and pick up teenage boys,
at
least in my case. But a couple of times truckers did pick me up. One time in central Colorado, a trucker pulled over for me and opened the side door. I was there and I had my denim jacket and my denim pants and my denim knapsack. And he opened the passenger door and he looked at me and he was like, "Aw, damn." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, get in." And I climbed up in the cab and we headed off down the road. And I was like, "What?" And he said, "Well, I thought you were my brother." And he pointed, you know, this all happened in the first minute in the cab. He pointed over to the left and he was like, "My brother's in that prison. And I saw you on the side of the road. I could have sworn you were him. You dressed all in denim. I thought maybe he'd hop the wall. And so I went past you. I got off at the next exit. I turned around. I came back going the other way.
Wow.
Looked at you real careful as I went by and swore you were him. Got off at that exit, turned around and came all the way back to get you. And then I realized you're not my brother, but I'll give you a ride wherever you're going." And we drove on into the night and, you know, and he had some speed and we just did the whole trucker thing together.
Is that the only way I got a ride? Is I must have looked like Fuzzy's convict brother, Wuzzy, or something?
Well, maybe you were out in the middle of
nowhere.
Maybe
I looked much more helpless.
Yeah.
With my sad gas can or something.
I apparently looked like somebody who had just hopped the wall out of prison.
That's who you want to give a ride to, for sure.
If it's your brother.
And that concludes Trucker Culture, entry MT2514, certificate number 25007, in the Omnibus. Futurelings, we have moved from CB radio to much more vile and pernicious social media platforms.
It gets worse and worse.
It gets worse. CB radio is the best social media platform. Really? Remember all the good times we had?
Oh, talking to the duck and the bear and the frog and the fuzz.
Worried about all the smokies. Good times. It was a simpler time. Now we're just always talking about the tea and the
The whatever, the slap,
the thank you next on Twitter and Instagram, where you can find us at Omnibus Project or at John Roderick or at Ken Jennings. You can also find our Facebook enthusiasts. This is much more like a CB chat, because CB could be communal, right? You could have multiple people cutting in and out and talking at once.
Oh, sure. You're chit-chatting. I mean, that's why you say breaker, breaker, because the assumption is that other people are talking and you want to get in there. Breaker means like coming in, hot.
That's how we should do the show now. Like, you're just talking. You're just saying something. Like, here, just say something.
Hey, well, anyway. So
breaker, breaker. Let's talk about Betty Ford more.
Boy. I don't know if I like that.
We never talked about trucker hats.
Trucker hats didn't really appear on the scene again until 2005.
That was
right?
Like Ashton Kutcher's fault. Yeah. He thought he could bring that back. Maybe he wanted to get a Southerner elected president again. I don't know what his plan was.
Who knows what his plan was? MILF chaser?
Maybe Demi just really liked the look of a guy in a trucker hat. So if you want that kind of communal attitude, just go to the Futurelings Facebook group and post something right now. Begin with breaker, breaker, so they know to stop what they're doing.
Breaker, breaker 19. This here's a rubber duck. Get your hand, got your ears on. That's what it is. Get your ears on.
If they don't have their ears on, they can't even hear you. So you don't have
right.
You don't have to tell
why
them.
Why are you asking that?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can, if you want to send us a trucker hat or a little US-1 Tyco slot truck, you can send us any and all.
I'd like that.
Yeah, you can send us any and all long-haul related, big rig-related memorabilia at our physical address, which is Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shiketown, Washington. No, Shoreline, Washington, which does not have a CB nickname.
Boreline.
More like Boreline. 98155. If you want to send us something of a more virtual, ephemeral nature, ones and zeros, you can send those to omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com.
Futurelings, from our vantage point out on that long, loathsome highway where Ken and I are the last two outlaws in America, we have no idea how long our civilization survived.
Before it turns into more of a Mad Max kind of trucking
world.
Yeah,
it may have collapsed when Ken and I went on strike.
The podcaster strike is going to bring America to its knees.
The podcaster strike, and everybody's just wandering around like forced to listen to music again.
Podcasting killed CB, in my opinion. Like, you don't want to listen to anything else in your car when you've got, Roman Mars talking to you or something.
That's right. Although in CB culture, if you were a pedant, you could always go breaker, breaker. That's actually not how World War I ended.
Ira Glass, I don't know what you're talking about. There is always that moment in the podcast where the people are like, oh, and what's the name of the, it's the U2 record after Octane Baby. And you're like, come on, you idiots.
Yeah.
And then
people would breaker, breaker all the time.
Breaker, breaker. It's called Zooropa.
Or in our case, it's like breaker, breaker. You forgot to mention the one character that appeared in that obscure film. Yeah.
Breaker, breaker. You did not follow every tangent about that topic.
Breaker, breaker. My grandfather actually was there that day.
Those are the ones you want.
Yeah,
those are the good ones.
I love those ones. Anyway, we hope and pray that this catastrophe we fear may never come, and that podcasting remains America's premier media.
We want to be in your 20 forever.
But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, in the form of a Oort cloud of Cthulhu's, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.